Marley was dead. To begin with, there is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clerk, the clergyman, the undertaker, the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. Old Marley was dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead. Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years, though Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name. There it stood years afterwards above the warehouse door, Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley, but he answered to both names. It was all the same to him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days, and he didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, nor wintry weather chill him. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming would tug their owners into doorways and up courts. But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked, to edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance. Once upon a time, and of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting-house. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The city clocks had only just gone 3, but it was quite dark already. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open, that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who, in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal, but he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Whereupon the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed.
"A Merry Christmas, Uncle!"
It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach. He had so heated himself with rapid walking in the fog and the frost, this nephew of Scrooge's, that he was all in a glow. His face was ruddy and handsome, and his eyes sparkled.
"Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you!"
"Ah," said Scrooge. "Humbug."
"Christmas a humbug, Uncle? You don't mean that, I'm sure."
"I do." "Merry Christmas!"
"Oh, don't be cross, Uncle."
"What else can I be when I live in such a world of fools as this? Merry Christmas! Out upon Merry Christmas! What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer? If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
Uncle,
nephew, Keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine.
Keep it? But you don't keep it.
Come, dine with us tomorrow. I'll see you in hell first.
But why? Why?
Good afternoon.
I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why cannot we be friends?
Good afternoon.
Well, I'm sorry with all my heart to find you so resolute. But I'll keep my Christmas humor to the last. So, Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon.
And a Happy New Year.
Good afternoon.
His nephew left the room, but stopped at the outer door to bestow the greetings of the season on the clerk, who, cold as he was warmer than Scrooge, for he returned them cordially.
There's another fellow, my clerk, with 15 shillings a week and a wife and family, talking about a Merry Christmas. I'll retire to Bedlam.
The clerk, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands, and they bowed to him.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years, said Scrooge. He died 7 years ago, this very night.
We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner. At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries, and hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir.
Are there no prisons?
Oh, plenty of prisons.
And the union workhouses, are they still in operation?
Oh, they are still. I wish I could say they were not.
The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigour, then?
Both very busy, sir.
Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their usual course. I'm very glad to hear it.
Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, a few of us, Mr. Scrooge, are endeavouring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall we put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there.
But many can't go there, Mr. Scrooge, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentlemen withdrew. Scrooge resumed his labours with an improved opinion of himself. And the fog and the darkness thickened. Thickened so that people ran about with flaring links, proffering their services to go before horses in carriages and conduct them on their way. The ancient tower of a church, whose gruff old bell was always peeping slyly down at Scrooge out of a Gothic window in the wall, became invisible and struck the hours and quarters in the clouds with tremulous vibrations afterwards, as if its teeth were chattering in its frozen head up there. The cold became intense. In the main street at the corner of the court, some labourers were repairing the gas pipes and had lighted a great fire in a brazier, round which a party of ragged men and boys were gathered, warming their hands and winking their eyes before the blaze in rapture. Foggier yet, and colder, piercing, searching, biting cold. The owner of a scant young nose, gnawed by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol.
God bless you, merry gentlemen, may not think you dismay. Remember,
Scrooge seized the ruler with such energy of action that the singer fled in terror, leaving the keyhole to the fog and even more congenial frost. At length, the hour of shutting up the counting house arrived. With an ill will, Scrooge dismounted from his stool and tacitly admitted the fact to the expectant clerk in the tank, who instantly snuffed his candle out and put on his hat. "You will want all day tomorrow, I suppose?"
"Oh, if quite convenient, sir."
"It's not convenient, and it's not fair. If I was to stop half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used, I'll be bound. And yet you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work."
"Well, it's only once a year."
"A poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December. But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier next morning."
The clerk promised that he would, and, buttoning his greatcoat to the chin, Scrooge walked out. The office was closed in a twinkling, and the clerk, with the long ends of his white comforter dangling below his waist, for he boasted no greatcoat, went down a slide on Cornhill at the end of a lane of boys 20 times in honour of its being Christmas Eve, and then ran home to Camden Town as hard as he could pelt to play at blind man's buff. Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern, and having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, went home to bed. He lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner. They were a gloomy suite of rooms in a lowering pile of a building up a yard, where it had so little business to be that one could scarcely help fancying it must have run there when it was a young house, playing at hide-and-seek with other houses, and have forgotten the way out again. It was old enough now, and dreary enough, for nobody lived in it but Scrooge, the other rooms being all let out as offices. Now, it is a fact that there was nothing at all particular about the knocker on the door, except that it was very large. It is also a fact that Scrooge had seen it night and morning during his whole residence in that place. Also that Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the city of London. Let it also be borne in mind that Scrooge had not bestowed one thought on Marley since his last mention of his 7 years dead partner that afternoon. And then, let any man explain to me, if he can, how it happened that Scrooge, having his key in the lock of the door, saw in the knocker, without its undergoing any intermediate process of change, not a knocker, but
Marley's face.
Marley's face. It was not in impenetrable shadow, as the other objects in the yard were, but had a dismal light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar. It was not angry or ferocious, but looked at Scrooge as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up upon its ghostly forehead. The hair was curiously stirred, as if by breath or hot air, and though the eyes were wide open, they were perfectly motionless. As Scrooge looked fixedly at this phenomenon, it was a knocker again. To say that he was not startled would be untrue, but he put his hand upon the key he had relinquished, turned it sturdily, walked in, and lighted his candle. He did pause with a moment's irresolution before he shut the door, and he did look cautiously behind it first, as if he half expected the sight of Marley's pigtail sticking out into the hall. But there was nothing on the back of the door except the screws and nuts that held the knocker on, so he said, "Ah," and closed it with a bang. The sound resounded through the house like thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellars below appeared to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He fastened the door and walked across the hall and up the stairs, slowly too, trimming his candle as he went, for it was pretty dark. But up Scrooge went, not caring a button for that. Darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it. but before he shut his heavy door, he walked through his rooms to see that all was right. He had just enough recollection of the face to desire to do that. Sitting room, bedroom, lumber room, nobody. Nobody in the closet. Nobody in his dressing gown, which was hanging up in a suspicious attitude against the wall. Quite satisfied, he closed his door and locked himself in. Double locked himself in, which was not his custom. Thus, secured against surprise, he took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers and his nightcap, and sat down before the fire to take his gruel. It was a very low fire indeed, nothing on such a bitter night. He was obliged to sit close to it and brood over it before he could extract the least sensation of warmth from such a handful of fuel. The fireplace was an old one, built by some Dutch merchant long ago, and paved all round with quaint Dutch tiles. But if each smooth tile had been a blank at first, now there was a copy of old Marley's head on every one. Scrooge's glance happened to rest upon a bell, a disused bell that hung in the room and communicated for some purpose now forgotten with a chamber in the highest story of the building. It was, with great astonishment, and with a strange, inexplicable dread, that as he looked, he saw this bell begin to swing. Clang, 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 clang. It swung so softly in the outset that it scarcely made a sound. Clang, 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 clang. But soon it rang out loudly, and so did every bell in the house. Clang, 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 clang. This might have lasted half a minute or a minute, but it seemed like an hour. Clang, 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 clang. The bells ceased as they had begun, together. They were succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain over the casks in the wine merchant's cellar. Scrooge then remembered to have heard that ghosts in haunted houses were described as dragging chains. He heard the cellar door fly open with a booming sound, and then the noise much louder on the floors below, then coming up the stairs, then coming straight towards his door. It's humbug still. I won't believe it. His colour changed, though, when, without a pause, it came on through the heavy door and passed into the room before his eyes. Upon its coming in, the dying flame leapt up as though it cried, "I know him! Marley's ghost!" The same face. The very same. Marley, in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights and boots, the tassels on the latter bristling, like his pigtail, and his coat skirts, and the hair upon his head. The chain he drew was clasped about his middle. It was long and wound about him like a tail, and it was made, for Scrooge observed it closely, of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses wrought in steel. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he had never believed it until now. No, nor did he believe it even now, though he looked the phantom through and through, and marked the very texture of the folded kerchief bound about its head and chin. "How now? What do you want with me?"
"Much."
Marley's voice, no doubt about it.
"Who are you?"
"Ask me who I was."
"Who were you, then?"
"In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley."
Can you sit down?"
"I can."
"Do it, then."
Scrooge asked the question because he didn't know whether a ghost so transparent might find himself in a condition to take a chair. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace as if he were quite used to it.
"You don't believe in me?"
"I don't."
Scrooge held on tight to his chair to save himself from falling in a swoon. But how much greater was his horror when the phantom, taking off the bandage round its head as if it were too warm to wear indoors, its lower jaw dropped down upon its breast.
Dreadful apparition, why do you trouble me?
Man of the worldly mind, do you believe in me or not?
I do. I must. But why do spirits walk the earth, and why do they come to me?
It is required of every man that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men and travel far and wide. And if that spirit goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death. It is doomed to wander through the world. Oh, woe is me! And witness what it cannot share, but might have shared on earth, and turned into happiness.
You are fettered. Tell me why.
I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link, and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Is its pattern strange to you, or would you know the weight and length of the strong coil you bear yourself? It was full as heavy and as long as this 7 Christmas Eves ago. You have laboured on it since. It is a ponderous chain.
Scrooge glanced about him on the floor in the expectation of finding himself surrounded by some 50 or 60 fathoms of iron cable, but he could see nothing.
Jacob, old Jacob Marley, tell me more. Speak comfort to me, Jacob.
I have none to give. It comes from other regions, Ebenezer Scrooge, and is conveyed by other ministers to other kinds of men. My spirit never walked beyond our counting house. Mark me. In life my spirit never roved beyond the narrow limits of our body-changing hole. I never knew that any Christian spirit, working kindly in its little sphere, whatever it may be, will find its mortal life too short for its vast means of usefulness. Never knew that no space of regret can make amends for one's life's opportunity misused. Yet such was I. Oh, such was I.
But you were always a good man of business, Jacob.
Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business.
It held up its chain at arm's length, as if that were the cause of all its unavailing grief, and flung it heavily upon the ground again.
At this time of the rolling year, I suffer most. I am here tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate, a chance and hope of my procuring, Ebenezer. You will be haunted by 3 spirits. Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tomorrow, when the bell tolls 1. Expect the second on the next night at the same hour. The third upon the next night, when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate.
Couldn't I take them all at once and have it over, Jacob?
Look to see me no more. And look that for your own sake. You remember what has passed between us.
When it had said these words, the spectre took its wrapper from the table and bound it round its head as before. Scrooge knew this by the smart sound its teeth made when the jaws were brought together by the bandage. He ventured to raise his eyes again, and found his supernatural visitor confronting him in an erect attitude, with its chain wound over and about its arm. The apparition walked backward from him, and at every step it took, the window raised itself a little, so that when the spectre reached it, it was wide open.
It beckoned Scrooge to approach, which he did. When they were within 2 paces of each other, Marley's ghost held up its hand, warning him to come no nearer. Scrooge stopped, not so much in obedience as in surprise and fear, for on the raising of the hand, he became sensible of confused noises in the air, incoherent sounds of lamentation and regret, wailings inexpressibly sorrowful and self-accusatory. The spectre, after listening for a moment, joined in the mournful dirge and floated out upon the bleak, dark night. Scrooge followed to the window, desperate in his curiosity. The air was filled with phantoms, wandering hither and thither in restless haste, and moaning as they went. Every one of them wore chains like Marley's ghost. Many had been personally known to Scrooge in their lives. He had been quite familiar with one old ghost in a white waistcoat, with a monstrous iron safe attached to its ankle, who cried piteously at being unable to assist a wretched woman with an infant whom it saw below upon a doorstep. The misery with them all was clearly that they sought to interfere for good in human matters, and had lost the power forever. Whether these creatures faded into mist, or mist enshrouded them, he could not tell, but they and their spirit voices faded together, and the night became as it had been when he walked home. Scrooge closed the window, and examined the door by which the ghost had entered. It was double-locked, as he had locked it with his own hands, and the bolts were undisturbed. And being, from the emotion he had undergone, or the fatigues of the day, or his glimpse of the invisible world, or the dull conversation of the ghost, or the lateness of the hour, much in need of repose, went straight to bed, and fell asleep upon the instant.
Ding-dong, 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 ding-dong,
what?
Ding-dong, ga-doing, 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 ga-doing. Gadoing, 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 gadoing.
What? But,
gadoing.
9?
Gadoing.
10?
Gadoing.
11?
Gadoing.
12? It was past 2 when I went to bed. 12? It isn't possible that I can have slept through a whole day and far into another night. It isn't possible that anything has happened to the sun, and this is 12 at noon. Scrooge thought and thought and thought it over and over and over, and he could make nothing of it. He lay in this state until the chimes had gone 3 quarters more, when he remembered, on a sudden, that the ghost had warned him of a visitation when the bell tolled 1. He resolved to lie awake until the hour was past. The quarter was so long that he was more than once convinced he must have sunk into a doze unconsciously and missed the clock. At length, it broke upon his listening ear.
Ding, dong, ding, dong.
1:15.
Ding, dong, ding, dong.
1:30.
Ding, dong, ding, dong.
1:45.
Ding, dong, ding, dong.
the hour itself, and nothing else.
He spoke before the hour had sounded, which it now did with a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy gadong.
Light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn aside. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand. Not the curtains at his feet, nor the curtains at his back, but those to which his face was addressed. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge, starting up into a half-recumbent attitude, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor who drew them. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as like an old man, viewed through some supernatural medium which gave him the appearance of having receded from the view and being diminished to a child's proportions. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it and the tenderest blooms on the skin. Its legs and feet, most delicately formed, were, like its upper members, bare. It wore a tunic of the purest white, and round its waist was bound a lustrous belt, the sheen of which was beautiful. It held a branch of fresh green holly in its hand, and, in singular contradiction of that wintry emblem, had its dress trimmed with summer flowers. But the strangest thing about it was that from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light by which all this was visible, and which was doubtless the occasion of its using, in its duller moments, a great extinguisher for a cap which it now held under its arm. Are you the spirit whose coming was foretold to me?
I am.
Who and what are you?
I am the ghost of Christmas past.
Long past?
No. Your past. Perhaps Scrooge could not have told anybody why, if anybody could have asked him, but he had a special desire to see the spirit in his cap, and he begged him to be covered.
What?
Would you so soon put out with worldly hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you are one of those whose passions made this cap, and force me through whole trains of years to wear it low upon my brow?
What business brings you here?
Your welfare.
I'm much obliged, but a night of unbroken rest would have been more conducive to that end.
Your reclamation, then. Take heed. It put out its strong hand as it spoke, and clasped him gently by the arm. Rise and walk with me. It would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted to pedestrian purposes, that he was clad but lightly in his slippers, dressing gown, and nightcap. The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit made towards the window, clasped its robe in supplication. I am a mortal and liable to fall. Bear but a touch of my hand there upon your heart, and you shall be upheld in more than this. As the words were spoken, they passed through the wall and stood upon an open country road with fields on either hand. The city had entirely vanished. Not a vestige of it was to be seen. The darkness and the mist had vanished with it, for it was a clear, cold winter day with snow upon the ground.
Good heavens, I was bred in this place. I was a boy here.
You recollect the way?
Remember it? I could walk it blindfold.
Strange to have forgotten it for so many years. They walked along the road, Scrooge recognizing every gate and post and tree, until a little market town appeared in the distance with its bridge, its church and winding river. some shaggy ponies now were seen trotting towards them with boys upon their backs, who called to other boys in country gigs and carts driven by farmers. All these boys were in great spirits and shouted to each other until the broad fields were so full of merry music that the crisp air laughed to hear it. These are but shadows of the things that have been. They have no consciousness of us. The jocund travellers came on, and as they came, Scrooge knew and named them every one. He heard them give each other Merry Christmas as they parted at crossroads and byways for their several homes. The school is not quite deserted, said the ghost. A solitary child, neglected by his friends, is left there still. They left the high road by a well-remembered lane, and soon approached a mansion of dull red brick, with a little weathercock-surmounted cupola on the roof and a bell hanging in it. It was a large house, but one of broken fortunes. Entering the dreary hall and glancing through the open doors of many rooms, they found them poorly furnished, cold and vast. There was an earthy savour in the air, a chilly bareness in the place, which associated itself somehow with too much getting up by candlelight and not too much to eat. They went, the ghost and Scrooge, across the hall to a door at the back of the house. It opened before them and disclosed a long, bare, melancholy room, made barer still by lines of plain deal forms and desks. At one of these, a boy was reading near a feeble fire, and Scrooge himself sat down upon a form and looked upon his poor, forgotten self as he had used to be. I wish... What is the matter?
Nothing. There was a boy singing a Christmas carol at my door last night. I should have liked to have given him something, that's all.
The ghost smiled thoughtfully and waved its hand, saying as it did so, "Let us see another Christmas." Scrooge's former self grew larger at the words, and the room became a little darker and more dirty. The panels shrunk, the windows cracked, fragments of plaster fell out of the ceiling, and the naked laths were shown instead. But how all this was brought about, Scrooge knew no more than you do. He only knew that it was quite correct, that everything had happened so, that there he was, alone again, when all the other boys had gone home for the holidays. He was not reading now, but walking up and down despairingly. Scrooge suddenly glanced anxiously towards the door. It opened, and a little girl, much younger than the boy, came darting in. She threw her arms about his neck and kissed him again and again. "Dear, dear brother, I've come to bring you home, dear brother, to bring you home, 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 home for good and all, home for ever and ever. Oh, father is so much kinder than he used to be that home's like heaven. He spoke so gently to me one night when I was going to bed that I was not afraid to ask him once more if you might come home. And he said, yes, you should, and sent me in a coach to bring you, and you're to be a man and are never to come back here. But first, we're to be together all the Christmas long and have the merriest time in the world." She began to drag him in her childish eagerness towards the door, and he, nothing loath to go, accompanied her.
"Always a delicate creature, whom a breath might have withered," said the ghost. "But she had a large heart."
"So she had. You're right. I'll not gainsay it, spirit. God forbid.
She died a woman, and had, as I think, children.
One child.
True. Your nephew...
Yes.
At that moment, they left the school behind them and were now in the busy thoroughfares of a city. It was made plain enough by the dressing of the shops that here, too, it was Christmas time again. But it was evening, and the streets were lighted up. The ghost stopped at a certain warehouse door and asked Scrooge if he knew it.
"Know it? I was apprenticed here."
They went in.
An old gentleman in a Welsh wig was sitting behind such a high desk that if he had been 2 inches taller, he must have knocked his head against the ceiling.
Why, it's old Fezziwig. It's Fezziwig alive again.
Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and looked up at the clock, which pointed to the hour of 7. He rubbed his hands, adjusted his capacious waistcoat, and called out, "Yo-ho there, Ebenezer Dick!" Scrooge's former self, now grown a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow prentice.
It's Dick Wilkins, to be sure, said Scrooge.
"Yo-ho, my boys, no more work tonight. Christmas Eve, Dick! Christmas, Ebenezer! Let's have the shutters up before a man can say Jack Robinson!"
You wouldn't believe how those two fellows went at it. They charged into the street with the shutters. 1, 2, 3, had 'em up in their places. 4, 5, 6, barred 'em and pinned 'em. 7, 8, 9, and came back before you could have got to 12, panting like racehorses.
Hilly hi ho ho!
Fezziwig skipped down from the high desk with wonderful agility.
"Clear away, my lads! Let's have lots of room here!"
The floor was swept and watered, the lamps were trimmed, fuel was heaped upon the fire, and the warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler with a music book, and went up to the lofty desk and made an orchestra of it, and tuned like 50 stomachaches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came the 3 Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the 6 young followers, whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In came the housemaid with her cousin, the baker. In came the cook with her brother's particular friend, the milkman. In came the boy from over the way, who was suspected of not having board enough from his master, trying to hide himself behind the girl from next door but one, who was proved to have had her ears pulled by her mistress. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some gracefully, some awkwardly, some pushing, some pulling. In they all came, anyhow and everyhow. There were dances, and there were forfeits, and more dances, and there was cake, and there was negus, and there was a great piece of cold roast, and there was a great piece of cold boiled, and there were mince pies and plenty of beer. But the great effect of the evening came after the roast and boiled, when the fiddler struck up Sir Roger de Coverley. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig, top couple too, with a good stiff piece of work cut out for them, 3 or 4 and 20 pair of partners. But if there had been twice as many, 4 times, old Fezziwig would have been a match for them, and so would Mrs. Fezziwig. A positive light appeared to issue from Fezziwig's calves. They shone in every part of the dance like moons. When the clock struck 11, this domestic ball broke up. Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations, one on either side of the door, and shaking hands with every person individually as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas. When everybody had retired but the 2 prentices, they did the same to them. Scrooge's former self turned down the lamps, and the cheerful voices died away, and Scrooge and the ghost again stood side by side in the open air. A small matter to make these silly folks so full of gratitude. He has but spent a few pounds of your mortal money, 3 or 4, perhaps.
It isn't that. It isn't that, Spirit. He had the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome, a pleasure or a toil. The happiness he gave is quite as great as if it cost a fortune.
My time grows short. Quick, said the ghost. This was not addressed to Scrooge, or to anyone whom he could see, but it produced an immediate effect, for again Scrooge saw himself. He was older now, a man in the prime of his life. His face had not the harsh and rigid lines of later years, but it had begun to wear the signs of care and avarice,
There was an eager, greedy, restless motion in the eye, which showed the passion that had taken root and where the shadow of the growing tree would fall. He was not alone, but sat by the side of a fair young girl in a mourning dress, in whose eyes there were tears. "Another idol has displaced me, and if it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, as I would have tried to do, I have no just cause to grieve."
"What idol has displaced you?" demanded young Ebenezer.
"A golden one."
"This is the even-handed dealing of the world. There is nothing on which it is so hard as poverty, and there is nothing it professes to condemn with such severity as the pursuit of wealth."
"Oh, you fear the world too much. All your other hopes have been merged into the hope of being beyond the chance of its sordid reproach. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one until the master passion gain engrosses you. Have I not?"
"What then? Even if I have grown so much wiser, what then? I am not changed towards you."
"You are changed. But today, tomorrow, yesterday, can I believe that you would choose a dowerless girl? I release you with a full heart for the love of him you once were. May you be happy in the life you have chosen."
And so she left him.
"Spirit, show me no more," said Scrooge. "Conduct me home. Why do you delight to torture me?"
"I told you these were shadows of the things that have been, that they are what they are. Do not blame me."
"Remove me! I cannot bear it!"
He turned upon the ghost and saw that it looked upon him with a face in which some strange way there were fragments of all the faces it had shown him.
"Leave me! Take me back! Haunt me no longer!"
Scrooge, observing that the spirit's light was burning high and bright, and dimly connecting that with its influence over him, he seized the extinguisher cap, and by a sudden action pressed it down upon its head. The spirit dropped beneath it, so that the extinguisher covered its whole form. But though Scrooge pressed it down with all his force, he could not hide the light, which streamed from under it in an unbroken flood upon the ground. He was conscious of being exhausted and overcome by an irresistible drowsiness, and furthermore of being in his own bedroom. He gave the cap a parting squeeze in which his hand relaxed, and had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep.
Awakening in the middle of a prodigiously tough snore, and sitting up in bed to get his thoughts together, Scrooge had no occasion to be told that the bell was again upon the stroke of one. He felt that he was restored to consciousness in the right nick of time for the especial purpose of holding a conference with the second messenger dispatched to him through Jacob Marley's intervention. But finding that he turned uncomfortably cold when he began to wonder which of his curtains this spectre would draw back, he put them everyone aside with his own hands, and lying down again, established a sharp lookout all round his bed, for he wished to challenge the spirit on the moment of its appearance, and he did not wish to be taken by surprise and made nervous. Now, being prepared for almost anything, he was not by any means prepared for nothing. And consequently, when the bell struck one, and no shape appeared, he was taken with a violent fit of trembling. But all this time he lay upon his bed, the very
core and center of a blaze of ruddy light which streamed upon it when the clock proclaimed the hour, and which, being only light, was more alarming than a dozen ghosts, as he was powerless to make out what it meant. At last, he began to think that the source and secret of this ghostly light might be in the adjoining room, from whence, on further tracing it, it seemed to shine. This idea taking full possession of his mind, he got up softly and shuffled in his slippers to the door. It was his own room. There was no doubt about that, but it had undergone a surprising transformation. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove, from every part of which bright, gleaming berries glistened. The crisp leaves of holly, mistletoe, and ivy reflected back the light as if so many little mirrors had been scattered there, and such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that dull petrification of a hearth had never known in Scrooge's time. Heaped upon the floor to form a kind of throne were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon this couch there sat a giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and held it up, high up, to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door. "Come in! Come in and know me better, man. I am the ghost of Christmas present. Look upon me." The ghost was clothed in one simple deep green robe, bordered with white fur. This garment hung so loosely on the figure that its capacious breast was bare. Its feet, observable beneath the ample folds of the garment, were also bare, and on its head it wore no other covering than a holly wreath, set here and there with shining icicles. Its dark brown curls were long and free, free as its genial face, its sparkling eye, its open hand, its unconstrained demeanor, and its joyful air. Girded round its middle was an antique scabbard, but no sword was in it, and the ancient sheath was eaten up with rust.
"You have never seen the like of me before?"
"Never."
"Have never walked forth with the younger members of my family, meaning, for I am very young, my elder brothers, born in these later years?"
"I don't think I have. I am afraid I have not. Have you had many brothers, Spirit?"
"More than 1,800.
A tremendous family to provide for."
The ghost of Christmas present rose.
"Touch my robe."
Scrooge did as he was told and held it fast. All vanished instantly. The room, the fire, the ruddy glow, the hour of night. And they stood in the city streets on Christmas morning. The sky was gloomy, and the shortest streets were choked up with a dingy mist, half thawed, half frozen, whose heavier particles descended in a shower of sooty atoms, as if all the chimneys in Great Britain had, by one consent, caught fire. There was nothing very cheerful in the climate or the town, and yet there was an air of cheerfulness abroad. The steeples called good people all to church and chapel, and away they came, flocking through the streets in their best clothes and with their gayest faces. Scrooge and the ghost went on, invisible, into the suburbs of the town and straight to Scrooge's clerk's house. Mrs. Cratchit, Bob Cratchit's wife,
dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, but brave in ribbons, which are cheap and make a goodly show for sixpence, was laying the cloth assisted by Belinda Cratchit, second of her daughters, also brave in ribbons, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes, getting the corners of his monstrous shirt collar, Bob's private property, into his mouth. And now two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelt the goose and known it for their own, and basking in luxurious thoughts of sage and onion, these young Cratchits danced about the table and exalted Master Peter Cratchit to the skies, while he, not proud, although his collars nearly choked him, blew the fire until the slow potatoes, bubbling up, knocked out loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled.
"What has ever got your precious father, then, and your brother, Tiny Tim, and Martha weren't as late last Christmas Day by half an hour?"
"Here's Martha, mother!" cried the young Cratchits. "Oh, there's such a goose, Martha!"
"Why, bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are," said Mrs. Cratchit, kissing her a dozen times and taking off her shawl and bonnet for her with officious zeal. "Well, never mind, so long as you come. Sit you down before the fire, my dear, and have a warm, Lord bless ye."
"No, no, there's father coming!"
cried the two young Cratchits, who were everywhere at once.
"Hide, Martha, hide!"
So Martha hid herself, and in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter, exclusive of the fringe, hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned and brushed to look seasonable, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas for Tiny Tim, he bore a little crutch, and had his limbs supported by an iron frame.
"Why, where's our Martha?" said Bob, looking round.
"Not coming."
"Not coming?
Not coming upon Christmas Day?"
Martha didn't like to see him disappointed, if it were only in joke. So she came out prematurely from behind the closet door and ran into his arms, while the two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim and bore him off into the wash-house that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper.
"And how did little Tim behave?"
asked Mrs. Cratchit, when Bob had hugged his daughter to his heart's content.
"Oh, as good as gold, and better. Somehow he gets thoughtful, sitting by himself so much, and he thinks the strangest things you ever heard. He told me, coming home, that he hoped the people saw him in the church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see. He's growing strong and hearty."
Tim's crutch was heard upon the floor, and back he came before another word was spoken, escorted by his brother and sister to his stool before the fire. And while Bob, turning up his cuffs, as if, poor fellow, they were capable of being made more shabby, compounded some hot mixture in a jug with gin and lemons, and stirred it round and round, and put it on the hob to simmer, Master Peter and the two ubiquitous young Cratchits went to fetch the goose, with which they soon returned in high procession. Such a bustle ensued that you might have thought a goose the rarest of all birds, a feathered phenomenon, to which a black swan was a matter of course. And in truth, it was something very like it in that house. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, ready beforehand in a little saucepan, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigour. Miss Belinda sweetened up the apple sauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him at a corner of the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their posts, crammed spoons into their mouths, lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. And at last the dishes were set on, and grace was said. "For what we are about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen."
It was succeeded by a breathless pause, as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it into the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all round the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat on the table with the handle of his knife and cried, "Hurrah!"
There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavor, size and cheapness were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by the apple sauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, surveying one small atom of a bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all at last. Yet everyone had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it in. Suppose it should not be done enough? Suppose it should break in turning out? Suppose somebody should have got over the wall of the backyard and stolen it while they were making merry with the goose? A supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid. All sorts of horrors were supposed. Hello? A great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. Ugh, a smell like washing day. Oh, that was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other, with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding like a speckled cannonball, so hard and firm, blazing in half a quartern of ignited brandy, and bedight with Christmas holly stuck into the top. Oh, a wonderful pudding! Bob Cratchit said that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess she had had her doubts about the quantity of flour. Everybody had something to say about it. But nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. It would have been flat heresy to do so. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing. At last, the dinner was all done. The cloth was cleared, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. The compound in the jug being tasted and considered perfect. Apples and oranges were put upon the table, and a shovelful of chestnuts on the fire. Then all the Cratchit family drew round the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, meaning half a one. And at Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. These held the hot stuff from the jug, however, as well as golden goblets would have done, and Bob served it out with beaming looks, while the chestnuts on the fire sputtered and crackled noisily. Then Bob proposed, "A Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us."
"God bless us, everyone," said Tiny Tim.
He sat very close to his father's side, and Bob held his withered little hand in his.
"Spirit," said Scrooge, "tell me if Tiny Tim will live."
"I see a vacant seat in the poor chimney corner, and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, the child will die. None other of my race will find him here."
"What then?"
"If he be like to die, he had better do it, and decrease the surplus population."
Scrooge hung his head to hear his own words quoted by the spirit.
"Man, if man you be in heart, not adamant, forbear that wicked cant until you have discovered what the surplus is and where it is. Will you decide what men shall live and what men shall die? It may be that in the sight of heaven you are more worthless and less fit to live than millions like this poor man's child."
Scrooge bent before the ghost's rebuke and cast his eyes upon the ground. But he raised them speedily on hearing his own name.
"Mr. Scrooge, I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast."
"The founder of the feast, indeed! Oh, I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I hope he'd have a good appetite for it."
"Oh, my dear, the children, Christmas Day. It should be Christmas Day, I'm sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy,
hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. Oh, you know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow.
My dear, Christmas Day.
Well, I'll drink his health for your sake and the day's, not for his. Long life to him. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings which had no heartiness in it. Tiny Tim drank it last of all, but he didn't care tuppence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for full 5 minutes. But after it had passed away, they were 10 times merrier than before, from the mere relief of Scrooge the Baleful being done with. The chestnuts and the jug went round and round, and by, they had a song from Tiny Tim.
Underneath the gas light's glitter stands a little fragile girl, heedless of the night winds bitter, while the snowflakes round her whirl. There are many sad and weary in this pleasant world of ours. Still she cries to all who pass her, won't you buy my pretty flowers?
There was nothing of high mark in this. They were not a handsome family. They were not well-dressed. Their shoes were far from being waterproof. Their clothes were scanty. But they were happy, grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time. And when they faded and looked happier yet in the bright sprinklings of the spirit's torch at parting, Scrooge had his eye upon them, and especially on Tiny Tim, until the last. By this time, it was getting dark and snowing pretty heavily, and as Scrooge and the spirit went along the streets, the brightness of the roaring fires in kitchens, parlours, and all sorts of rooms was wonderful. Blessings on it, how the ghost exulted, how it bared its breadth of breast and opened its capacious palm and floated on, outpouring with a generous hand its bright and harmless mirth on everything within its reach. But now, without a word of warning from the ghost, they stood upon a bleak moor.
"What place is this?" said Scrooge.
"A place where miners live, who labor in the bowels of the earth, but they know me. See."
A light shone from the window of a hut, and swiftly they advanced towards it. Passing through the wall of mud and stone, they found a cheerful company assembled round a glowing fire. An old, old man and woman, with their children's children and another generation beyond that, all decked out gaily in their holiday attire. The spirit did not tarry here, but bade Scrooge hold his robe, and passing on above the moor, sped out to sea. Built upon a dismal reef of sunken rocks, some league or so from shore, on which the waters chafed and dashed the wild year through, there stood a solitary lighthouse. But even here, two men who watched the light had made a fire that through the loophole in the thick stone wall shed out a ray of brightness on that awful sea. Joining their hands over the rough table at which they sat, they wished each other Merry Christmas in their can of grog. Again the ghost sped on above the black and heaving sea, on, until, being far away from any shore, they lighted on a ship. They stood beside the helmsman at the wheel, the lookout in the bow, the officers who had the watch, dark, ghostly figures in their several stations, but every man among them hummed a Christmas tune, or had a Christmas thought, or spoke below his breath to his companion of some bygone Christmas day, with homeward hopes belonging to it.
Ha 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 ha!
It was a great surprise to Scrooge to hear that hearty laugh. It was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognize it as his own nephew's, and to find himself in a bright, dry, gleaming room, with the spirit standing smiling by his side, and looking at that same nephew with approving affability.
"He said that Christmas was a humbug, as I live," cried Scrooge's nephew. "He believed it, too."
"More shame for him, Fred," said Scrooge's niece.
"Well, he's a comical old fellow, that's the truth, and not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offences carry their own punishment, and I'm sorry for him. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried. Who suffers by his ill whims? Himself, always. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us. What's the consequence? He loses some pleasant moments which could do him no harm. I'm sure he loses pleasanter companions than he can find in his own thoughts, either in his mouldy old office or his dusty chambers. I mean to give him the same chance every year, whether he likes it or not. And I think I shook him yesterday."
It was the company's turn to laugh now at the notion of his shaking Scrooge. But being thoroughly good-natured, and not much caring what they laughed at, so that they laughed at any rate, he encouraged them in their merriment. But the whole scene passed, and Scrooge and the spirit were again upon their travels. Much they saw, and far they went, and many homes they visited, but always with a happy end. The spirit stood beside sick beds, and they were cheerful, on foreign lands, and they were close at home, by struggling men, and they were patient in their greater hope, by poverty, and it was rich, in almshouse, hospital, and jail, in misery's every refuge, where vain man in his little brief authority had not made fast the door and barred the spirit out, he left his blessing and taught Scrooge his precepts. It was a long night. If it were only a night. But Scrooge had doubts of this, because the Christmas holidays appeared to be condensed into the space of time they passed together. It was strange, too, that while Scrooge remained unaltered in his outward form, the ghost grew older, clearly older. Scrooge had observed this change, but never spoke of it, until they left a children's Twelfth Night party, when, looking at the spirit as they stood together in an open place, he noticed that its hair was grey.
"Are spirits' lives so short?"
"My life upon this globe is very brief. It ends tonight, at midnight. Hark! The time is drawing near."
The chimes were ringing, the 11:15 at that moment.
"Spirit, forgive me if I am not justified in what I ask, but I see something strange and not belonging to yourself protruding from your skirts. Is it a foot or a claw?"
"It might be a claw for all the flesh there is upon it. Look here." From the foldings of its robe, it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment. "Oh, man, look here, look, look down here."
They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolvish, but prostrate, too, in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand, like that of age, had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade through all the mysteries of wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible and dread. Scrooge started back, appalled.
"Spirit, are they yours?"
"They are man's. Beware them both, and all of their degree, but most of all, Beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Deny it. Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your factious purposes and make it worse. And bide the end.
Have they no refuge or resource?
Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses? The bell struck 12.
Scrooge looked about him for the ghost and saw it not. But as the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground towards him. Slowly, gravely, silently. The very air through which this spirit moved seemed to scatter gloom and mystery.
It was shrouded in a deep black garment, which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. But for this it would have been difficult to detach its figure from the night and separate it from the darkness by which it was surrounded. Its mysterious presence filled him with a solemn dread.
I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come?
The spirit answered not, but pointed onward with its hand.
You are about to show me shadows of the things that have not happened, but will happen in the time before us. Is that so, spirit?
The upper portion of the garment was contracted for an instant in its folds, as if the spirit had inclined its head. That was the only answer he received. But Scrooge was all the worse for this. It thrilled him with a vague, uncertain horror to know that behind the dusky shroud there were ghostly eyes intently fixed upon him.
Lead on, spirit. Lead on. The night is waning fast, and it is precious time to me, I know. Lead on, spirit.
They scarcely seemed to enter the city, but there they were, in the heart of it, amongst the merchants who hurried up and down and chinked the money in their pockets and conversed in groups and looked at their watches and so forth, as Scrooge had seen them so often. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk.
"No, I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead."
"When did he die?"
"Last night, I believe."
"Why, what was the matter with him? I thought he'd never die."
"God knows."
"What has he done with his money?"
"Oh, I haven't heard. Left it to his company, perhaps. He hasn't left it to me. That's all I know."
"Well, it's likely to be a cheap funeral, for upon my life I don't know of anybody to go to it. Suppose we make up a party and volunteer."
"Well, I don't mind going if a lunch is provided, but I must be fed if I make one. Goodbye."
"Bye."
"Bye."
Speakers and listeners strolled away and mixed with other groups. Scrooge knew the men and looked towards the spirit for an explanation, but the phantom pointed to two persons meeting.
"How are you?"
"How are you?"
"Well, old Scratch has got his own at last, eh?"
"So I'm told."
"Cold, isn't it? Seasonable for Christmas time."
"Good morning."
"Good morning."
Not another word. That was their meeting, their conversation, and their parting. Scrooge was at first inclined to be surprised that the spirit should attach importance to conversations apparently so trivial. He looked about in that very place for his own image. But another man stood in his accustomed corner, and though the clock pointed to his usual time of the day for being there, he saw no likeness of himself among the multitudes that poured in through the porch. But now they left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of the town where Scrooge had never penetrated before, although he recognized its situation and its bad repute. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched, the people half-naked, drunken, slipshod, ugly. Alleys and archways, like so many cesspools, disgorged their offences of smell and dirt and life upon the straggling streets, and the whole quarter reeked with crime, with filth and misery. Far in this den of infamous resort, there was a low-browed, beetling shop below a penthouse roof, where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were bought. Upon the floor within were piled up heaps of rusty keys, nails, chains, hinges, files, scales, and weights, and refuse iron of all kinds. Sitting in among the wares he dealt in, by a charcoal stove made of old bricks, was a grey-haired rascal, nearly 70 years of age, who smoked his pipe in all the luxury of calm retirement. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. But she had scarcely entered when another woman, similarly laden, came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in faded black, who was no less startled by the sight of them than they had been upon the recognition of each other.
"Let the charwoman alone to be the first," cried she who had entered first. "Let the laundress alone to be the second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance, if we haven't all three met here without meaning it."
"You couldn't have met in a better place. Come into the parlour."
The woman, who had already spoken, threw her bundle on the floor and sat down in a flaunting manner on a stool, crossing her elbows on her knees, and looking with a bold defiance at the other two.
"What odds, then? What odds, Mrs. Dilber? Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did. Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose. If he wanted to keep them after he was dead, wicked old screw, why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death, instead of lying gasping out his last there alone by himself. Open that bundle, old Joe. Let me know the value of it."
But the gallantry of her friends would not allow of this, and the man in faded black, mounting the breach first, produced his plunder. It was not extensive. A seal or two, a pencil case, a pair of sleeve buttons, and a brooch of no great value at all. They were severally examined and appraised by old Joe, who chalked the sums he was disposed to give for each upon the wall, and added them up into a total when he found there was nothing more to come. Mrs. Dilber was next. Sheets and towels, a little wearing apparel, two old-fashioned silver teaspoons, a pair of sugar tongs, and a few boots. Her account was stated on the wall in the same manner.
"And now, undo my bundle, Joe."
Joe went down on his knees for the greater convenience of opening it, and having unfastened a great many knots, dragged out a large and heavy roll of some dark stuff.
"What do you call these? Bed curtains? You don't mean to say you took 'em down, rings and all, with him lying there?"
"Don't drop that oil upon them blankets now."
"His blankets?
Who else's do you think? He isn't likely to take cold without 'em, I dare say."
"I hope he didn't die of anything catching, eh?"
"Don't you be afraid of that. I ain't so fond of his company that I'd loiter about him for such things if he did. Ah, you may look through that shirt till your eyes ache, but you won't find a hole in it, nor a threadbare place. It's the best he had, and a fine one, too. They'd have wasted it if it hadn't have been for me."
"What you call wasting of it?"
"Putting it on him to be buried in. Somebody was fool enough to do it, but I took it off again."
Scrooge listened to this dialogue in horror. As they sat grouped about their spoil in the scanty light afforded by the old man's lamp, he viewed them with a detestation and disgust which could hardly have been greater had they been obscene demons marketing the corpse itself. The scene changed. And now, he almost touched a bed, a bare, uncurtained bed, on which Beneath a ragged sheet there lay something covered up, which, though it was dumb, announced itself in awful language. The room was very dark, too dark to be observed with any accuracy, though Scrooge glanced round it in obedience to a secret impulse, anxious to know what kind of room it was. A pale light, rising in the outer air, fell straight upon the bed, and on it, plundered and bereft, unwatched, unwept, uncared for, was the body of a man. Scrooge glanced towards the phantom. Its steady hand was pointed to the head. The cover was so carelessly adjusted that the slightest raising of it, the motion of a finger upon Scrooge's part, would have disclosed the face. He lay in the dark, empty house. A cat was tearing the door, and there was a sound of gnawing rats beneath the hearthstone. What they wanted in the room of death, and why they were so restless and disturbed, Scrooge did not dare to think.
Spirit, I understand you, and I would do it if I could, but I have not the power, Spirit. I have not the power.
Again, it seemed to look upon him.
But, Spirit, I beg, if there is any person in the town who feels emotion caused by this man's death, show that person to me, Spirit, I beseech you.
The phantom spread its dark robe before him for a moment, like a wing, and withdrawing it, revealed a room by daylight where a mother and her children were. She was expecting someone, and with anxious eagerness. At length, the long-expected knock was heard. She hurried to the door and met her husband, a man whose face was careworn and depressed. Though he was young, there was a remarkable expression in it now, a kind of serious delight of which he felt ashamed and which he struggled to repress.
Is it good or bad?
Bad.
We're quite ruined, then?
No, there's hope yet, Caroline.
If he relents, there is. Nothing is past hope, if such a miracle has happened.
He's past relenting. He's dead. She was a mild and patient creature, if her face spoke truth. But she was thankful in her soul to hear it, and she said so with clasped hands. Oh, she prayed forgiveness the next moment and was sorry, but the first was the emotion of her heart.
To whom will our debt be transferred?
I don't know, but before that time we shall be ready with the money. We may sleep tonight with light hearts, Caroline. Yes. Soften it as they would, their hearts were lighter. The children's faces, hushed and clustered round to hear what they so little understood, were brighter. And it was a happier house for this man's death. The only emotion that the ghost could show him, caused by the event, was one of pleasure.
Spirit, said Scrooge, let me see some tenderness connected with a death, or that dark chamber which we left just now will be forever present to me.
The ghost conducted him through several streets familiar to his feet, and they entered poor Bob Cratchit's house and found the mother and the children seated round the fire. Quiet. Very quiet. The noisy Cratchits were as still as statues in one corner, and sat looking up at Peter, who had a book before him. The mother and her daughters were engaged in sewing, but surely they were quiet. The mother laid her work on the table.
Colour hurts my eyes, she said. It makes them weak by candlelight, and I wouldn't show weak eyes to your father when he comes home for all the world. It must be near his time, but I think he's walked a little slower than he used these few last evenings. they were very quiet again. I've known him walk with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder very fast indeed. But, oh, he was light to carry, and his father loved him so that he was no trouble, no trouble. Oh, and there is your father at the door.
His tea was ready for him on the hob, and they all tried who should help him to it most. Then the two young Cratchits got upon his knees and laid each child a little cheek against his face, as if they said, "Don't mind it, father. Don't be grieved." Bob was cheerful with them and spoke pleasantly to all the family, and Mrs. Cratchit said,
You went today, then, Robert?"
"Oh, yes, my dear. I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. But you'll see it often. I promised him that we would walk there on a Sunday."
"My little child. My little, little child."
He couldn't help it. If he could have helped it, he and his child would have been further apart, perhaps, than they were. He left them and went upstairs into the room above, which was lighted cheerfully and hung with Christmas. There was a chair set close beside the body of the child, and there were signs of someone having been there lately. Bob sat down in it, and when he had thought a little and composed himself, he kissed the child's face. He was reconciled to what had happened, and went down again. And they drew about the fire and talked, the girls and mother working still. Bob told them of the extraordinary kindness of Mr. Scrooge's nephew, whom he had scarcely seen but once, and who, meeting him in the street that day, and seeing that he looked a little, well, just a little down, you know, inquired what had happened to distress him. "On which," said Bob, "for he is the pleasantest spoken gentleman you ever heard, I told him, 'I'm heartily sorry for it, Mr. Cratchit, and heartily sorry for your good wife.' It really seemed as if he had known our Tiny Tim and felt with us. But however and whenever we part from one another, I'm sure we shall none of us forget poor Tiny Tim, shall we, or this first parting that there was among us?"
"Never, father."
"And I know, my dears, that when we recollect how patient and how mild he was, although he was just a little, little child, we shall not quarrel easily among ourselves and forget poor Tiny Tim in doing it."
"No, never, father."
"I'm very happy," said Bob. "I am very happy."
"Spectre," said Scrooge, "something informs me that our parting moment is at hand. I know it, but I know not how. Tell me, what man that was whom we saw lying dead?"
The ghost of Christmas yet to come made no reply, but conveyed him as before until they reached an iron gate, a churchyard. Here, then, the wretched man whose name he had now to learn lay underneath the ground. The spirit stood among the graves and pointed down to one. Scrooge advanced towards it, trembling. The phantom was exactly as it had been, but he dreaded that he saw new meaning in its solemn shape.
"Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point, answer me one question. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they the shadows of things that may be only?"
Still the ghost pointed downward to the grave by which it stood.
"Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends, to which, if persevered in, they must lead. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me."
The spirit was immovable as ever, and Scrooge crept towards it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read upon the stone of the neglected grave his own name: Ebenezer Scrooge.
"Am I the man who lay upon the bed?"
The finger pointed from the grave to him and back again.
No, Spirit. Oh, no, no. Spirit, hear me. I am not the man I was. Why show me this if I am past all hope? Good Spirit, assure me that I yet may change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life. I will live in the past, present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me I may wash away the writing on this stone.
And there began an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrunk, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost. Yes, and the bedpost was his own. The room was his own. The bed curtains were his own. They are not torn down. They are not torn down, rings and all. They are here. I am here. The shadows of the things that would have been may be dispelled. They will be. I know they will. Really, for a man who had been out of practice for so many years, it was a splendid laugh, a most illustrious laugh, the father of a long, long line of brilliant laughs. Oh, I don't know what day of the month it is. I don't know how long I've been among the spirits. I don't know anything. He was checked in his transports by the churches ringing out the lustiest peals he had ever heard. Clash, clang, clash, hammer, ding, ding, dong, bell, bell, ding, dong, hammer, clang, clash, clang, clash. Running to the window, he opened it and put out his head. No fog, no mist, clear, bright, jovial, stirring, cold. Cold piping for the blood to dance on, golden sunlight, heavenly sky, sweet fresh air, merry bells, oh, glorious, glorious! Scrooge called downward to a boy in Sunday clothes.
What's today?
Eh?
Returned the boy.
What's today, my fine fellow?
Today? Why, it's Christmas Day!
It's Christmas Day. I haven't missed it. The spirits have done it all in one night. They can do anything they like. Of course they can.
Hello, my fine fellow.
Hello.
Do you know the poulterers in the next street but one, at the corner?
I should hope I did.
Oh, what an intelligent boy. A remarkable boy.
Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? The big one.
What? The one as big as me?
Oh, what a delightful boy. It's a pleasure to talk to him.
Yes, my buck.
Whoa, it's hanging up there now.
Is it? Go and buy it and tell them to bring it here that I may give them the direction where to take it. Come back with the man and I'll give you a shilling. Come back with him in less than 5 minutes, and I'll give you half a crown.
The boy was off like a shot. I'll send it to Bob Cratchit's. He shan't know who sends it. Scrooge went downstairs to open the street door, ready for the coming of the poulterer's man. As he stood there, waiting his arrival, the knocker caught his eye. I shall love it as long as I live. I scarcely ever looked at it before. Well, what an honest expression it has in its face. It's a wonderful knocker. Oh, here's the turkey. Hello. How are you? Merry Christmas. It was a turkey. He could never have stood upon his legs, that bird. He would have snapped them short off in a minute like sticks of sealing wax. Why, it's impossible to carry that to Camden Town. You must have a cab. The chuckle with which he said this, and the chuckle with which he paid for the turkey, and the chuckle with which he paid for the cab, and the chuckle with which he recompensed the boy, were only to be exceeded by the chuckle with which he sat down breathless in his chair again and chuckled till he cried. At last, he dressed himself all in his best and got out into the streets. The people were by this time pouring forth, as he had seen them, with the ghost of Christmas present. And walking with his hands behind him, Scrooge regarded everyone with a delighted smile. He looked irresistibly pleasant, that three or four good-humoured fellows said, "Ah, good morning, sir. Merry Christmas to you." And Scrooge said often afterwards that of all the blithe sounds he had ever heard, those were the blithest in his ears. He'd not gone far, however, when coming on towards him, he beheld the portly gentleman who had walked into his counting-house the day before. It sent a pang across his heart to think how this old gentleman would look upon him when they met. But he knew what path lay straight before him, and he took it. My dear sir, Scrooge took the old gentleman by both his hands. Ah, how do you do? I hope you succeeded yesterday. It was very kind of you. Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Mr. Scrooge?
Yes, that is my name, and I fear it may not be pleasant to you. Allow me to ask your pardon, and you have the goodness to... And here Scrooge whispered in his ear.
Lord bless me. My dear Mr. Scrooge, are you serious?
If you please, not a farthing less. A great many back payments are included in it, I assure you. Will you do me that favour?
Oh, my dear sir, I don't know what to say. Such
Don't say anything, please. Come and see me. Will you come and see me?
I will.
Well, thank you. I am much obliged to you. I thank you 50 times. Bless you. Scrooge found himself near the open door of a church. He went inside, and for the first time as a man, he joined his voice to those of his fellow creatures in a Christmas hymn.
God rest you, gentle, let nothing you dismay. Remember, Christ your Savior was born on Christmas Day. To save poor souls from Satan's power when they had gone astray. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
Afterwards, he walked about the streets and watched people hurrying to and fro and patted children on the head and questioned beggars, looked down into the kitchens of houses and up to the windows, and found that everything could yield him pleasure. He had never dreamed that any walk, that anything, could give him so much happiness. And in the afternoon, he turned his steps towards his nephew's house. He passed the door a dozen times before he had the courage to go up and knock, but he made a dash, and he did it. A young housemaid answered.
Is your master at home, my dear?
Yes, sir.
Where is he, my love?
Well, he's in the dining room, sir, along with mistress. I'll show you upstairs, if you please.
Oh, thank ye. He knows me. I'll just go in here, my dear.
He sidled his face round the door.
"Why, bless my soul!" cried Fred. "Who's that?"
"It's I, your Uncle Scrooge. I've come to dinner. Will you let me in, Fred?"
"Let him in? It is a mercy he didn't shake his arm off. He was at home in 5 minutes. Nothing could be heartier. Wonderful party, wonderful games, wonderful unanimity, wonderful happiness." But he was early at the office next morning. Oh, he was early there. If he could only be there first and catch Bob Cratchit coming late, that was the thing he had set his heart upon. And he did it. Yes, he did. The clock struck 9.
No, Bob,
A quarter past.
No, Bob. He was full 18 minutes and a half behind his time. Scrooge sat with his door wide open that he might see him come into the tank. Suddenly, Cratchit was there. His hat was off before he opened the door, his comforter too. He was on his stool in a jiffy, driving away with his pen as if he were trying to overtake 9 o'clock.
Hello, said Scrooge. And what do you mean by coming here at this time of day?
I'm very sorry, sir. I am behind my time.
You are? Oh, yes, I think you are. Step this way, if you please.
Well, it's only once a year, sir. It shall not be repeated. I was making rather merry yesterday, sir.
Now, I'll tell you what, my friend. I am not going to stand this sort of thing any longer. And therefore,
Scrooge leapt from his stool and, giving Bob such a dig in the waistcoat that he staggered back into the tank again, said,
And therefore, I am about to raise your salary.
Bob began to tremble and got a little nearer to the ruler. He had a momentary idea of knocking Scrooge down with it, holding him, and calling to the people in the court for help and a strait waistcoat.
A merry Christmas, Bob. A merrier Christmas, Bob, my good fellow, than I have given you for many a year. I will raise your salary and endeavour to assist your struggling family, and we will discuss your affairs this very afternoon over a Christmas bowl of smoking Bishop Bob. Make up the fires and buy another coal scuttle before you dot another I, Bob Cratchit.
Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all and infinitely more, and to Tiny Tim, who did not die. He was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew, or any other good old city, town, or borough in the good old world. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset, and knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. It was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.